and thus her testimony that the cause of death was homicide by asphyxiation was nothing more than bolstering of the state's witness testimony and their theory of the case. And finally, time permitting, the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt total transactions stolen in an amount to exceed the minimum threshold required by the offense of $100,000. Turning to the first argument.
Actually, Mrs. Voss, I want to address your second argument first as to whether Ms. Moscato is a cooperating accomplice as a matter of law.
Yes, sir.
Under what law are you saying that she is, as a matter of law, a cooperating that then cannot be used without uncorroborated evidence?
We believe that she was an accomplice under Section 22.04 of the Texas Penal Code, which is the statute that governs injury to a child, elderly individual, or disabled individual. While this is not technically a lesser included offense of capital murder, it is a related.
Do you have any law that says we can use that statute in order to find her a cooperating witness, since it's not a lesser included offense?
Yes, actually, Johnson versus State, Southwest, 234 Southwest 3rd, 43. It's cited in our brief. It's an El Paso case.
What was that case again? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. It's Johnson versus
Johnson
State, El Paso, 2007. In that case, Johnson was convicted for killing a child. Gaines was the mother of the child. Johnson said that Ms. Gaines was an accomplice witness. She pleaded guilty to injury of a child and was convicted, and the court treated her as an accomplice witness, even though the main case was a capital murder case. So you can use a related offense. What the Court of Criminal Appeals has said, that if it's a related offense, it's just you need some sort of a blameworthy participant is the language that we've used, or that they've used, and we've cited those cases in the brief.
Counsel, how do we get to caregiver in this case, considering looking at the things that the lady was doing and putting that with other testimony, like Mr. Talbot, and talking about the gentleman was completely lucid at the time he signed the will, just a matter, short time before that. How do we get to a caregiver status when what it appears as she was doing was basically household task for a man who was living by himself?
I understand the concern, and I think it derives from the state's confusion of the definition of a disabled individual versus an elderly individual. The statute applies to an elderly individual, which no one disputes that Mr. Nell satisfied the definition of an elderly individual in this case. A disabled individual is someone who actually requires full-time care because of a disability or health or mental health issue that makes them dependent on a caregiver. But an elderly person, that requirement is not in the statute. All that that's required is that you represent in some way to the public that you have taken responsibility for providing food, shelter, medical care, and providing for their needs. And she was. She testified that she was his caregiver. And in fact, Ms. Mascoro testified that he was frail and that he required care. She testified that she helped him bathe, she cooked his meals, she took him to the doctor, she made sure that he took his medicine, she bought him diapers. All of that is in the record. And so despite the state's attempt to engraft the disability language onto liability for harming an elderly individual, that's just not supported by the statutory language.
Did you have any case law supporting for an elderly person?
It's actually in the statute itself. The statute applies to an injury to an elderly person, which is a person over 65, a disabled individual, which has a separate definition and includes someone who would be dependent on care, and then a child. So the language, the dependency language comes in the definition of the.
Now, how do we separate that from a jury, obviously, making a decision based on credibility and them looking, obviously, at the facts and saying this was not a caregiver?
Well, the problem is it wasn't submitted to the jury. at all. There was no accomplice witness instruction that was given to the jury, so they never had to make that decision under the statute.
Did you ask for it at the jury charge conference?
No, Your Honor, we did not.
And did you ask for it at the motion for a directed verdict?
No, Your Honor. The only time that it was the accomplice status was referenced was immediately prior to Ms. Mascora's testimony, where there was a discussion about advising her on her Fifth Amendment rights because she could be an accomplice, and the trial court admonished her but stated his opinion that he didn't think that she was an accomplice. Of course, that was before all the testimony, but. Given that it was raised, there was no duty on the defense to actually ask for it in the jury charge. It is considered part of the law of the case that the judge is duty bound to instruct even in the absence of a request. And we've cited cases in our brief on that issue as well.
Even if we are to assume then, for the sake of argument this afternoon, that she is a corroborating witness, there is such a small burden that then is required to have any evidence than to corroborate a corroborating witness. I don't remember what the burden is, but it's very small. And even in your own brief, you say that the state relied on other evidence, the motive to receive Nell's estate. This is straight out of your brief. Patterson's presence of Nell's house that day, statements by Patterson on the video, Patterson's presentation to Nell's DNR reported at the time of his death. So isn't that even the evidence that you present that the state relied, besides Modosko's testimony, isn't that sufficient in order to substantiate this verdict?
No.
Why not?
First of all, it simply is not enough to prove that a person had a motive or that a person was present at the scene of an alleged crime with the alleged accomplice. In order to corroborate, you have to do something more. The evidence has to actually tend to connect the defendant to the crime, and it can't just be corroborating of details. And if you look through all of those items, and where I got those from were arguments that were made at the new trial hearing. Mm-hmm. So I addressed what the state had raised at the new trial hearing. And really, all of it is just there was a motive and there was an opportunity. But the courts have consistently said that simply is very weak corroborating evidence. And so I don't think that you get there. Now, is it sufficient to require a rendition? That's going to be up to the court on a case-by-case basis, because these cases are so fact-intensive, it is very difficult to find a case that's on all fours with your facts. They're all going to be very different. However, I think that at the very least, the evidence raised the issue of whether she was an accomplice. There should have been an instruction, and the corroborating evidence is very, very weak at best. So
what's the standard again, Mrs. Voss? Remind me. Is it it's less than scintilla of an evidence, right?
The evidence has to tend to connect.
And I think the case law is pretty low on the tend to connect. It doesn't have to prove that the murder was done, but just to connect the defendant to the crime.
Well, it does have to tend to connect. However, you need to look at the whole record, I think, when you make this evaluation. And when you have one witness, the only witness in the entire case who claims that there was a murder, and there's no physical evidence of a murder, and the only other testimony in the record that death was by homicide is from a medical examiner who had no evidence on autopsy and who only relied on the alleged accomplice witness, the weakness of the evidence is what the court should be considering.
Well, let's move on to Dr. Farley's testimony, because I've read, I think we all have read, the 75-page hearing that was held in the trial court, which was mostly the trial court and Mr. Flores, even though I saw that you tried to interrupt and he didn't let you. But, you know, it would seem that this is a gatekeeper case and that the trial judge in this case performed its duty as a gatekeeper. Didn't decide on your side, but he decided as to the qualifications and the basis of Dr. Farley's testimony as a forensic, of what every forensic doctor testifies in these types of cases.
Well, I disagree. I think that there are a lot of cases where a forensic expert will look at scientific evidence and then also will look at investigative materials. However, in this case, Dr. Norma Jean Farley said that she was giving a medical expert opinion based on a reasonable medical probability in front of this jury, when in fact she admitted that there was nothing on autopsy that supported the conclusion that this was a homicide by asphyxiation. She said there was no petechia. There none of the signs that typically would go along with some sort of a physical strangulation. There was none of that.
And a lot of times there isn't any signs.
Correct.
So you're asking her to prove signs when signs do not exist on asphyxiation, which occurs a lot of times as well. So that's what she was trying to do. And I think that what was attempted to do in her Kelly hearing was, did she rule everything else out?
And she did not. And that's the problem. The evidence showed that
I don't know. I thought that the trial judge kind of went through and asked her everything. Did he die from a heart attack? No. Did he die from cancer? No. I mean, she gave opinions.
She gave opinions, but she admitted that they were based on the investigative materials, because on further questioning by Mr. Flores, she admitted that the comorbidities that Mr. Nell had present, like the enlarged heart, that those could cause arrhythmias that would lead to a cardiac arrest that likewise would not show up on autopsy. And she testified that she could not rule that out. And in other words, you have one possible theory that does not show up on autopsy, and you have another possible theory that three EMS providers testified that's what they thought it was, cardiac arrest, and neither of those show up on autopsy. And so to make a decision between the two, she's not relying on scientific theory, scientific information. What she said she did was, she said she weighed the credibility of the investigative material, including Celestina Mascoro's statement, cell hawk data. So really what she's doing is providing an opinion that the state's other investigative materials are valid.
Were any of the medical records, specifically the EKGs that the paramedics performed at the scene, were they admitted in evidence?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head.
Because a heart attack would show up in that. I mean,
well, a heart attack would. Cardiac arrest is what Dr. Farley explained was different than a heart attack. It is an electrical failure in the heart that can be caused by an irregular heartbeat and is commonly associated with the types of comorbidities and would not show up on an EKG or on autopsy. And she could not rule out either of those. And we've cited numerous cases from around the country.
That was presented to the jury as well, though, wasn't it, that she couldn't rule out heart attack?
Yes. However, she then testified that her medical scientific opinion was that it was death by asphyxiation. And as we all know, and as
it's always becomes the battles of the experts. You always end up with the two experts battling as to who's right in all these types of cases. And I think that's what the comment from the trial court was. Well, then it becomes a credibility as to whether they believe, as to whether her assumptions are correct. Your time is up, Ms. Voss.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may proceed, Mr. Duke.
May I please court, Madam Justice, members of the court? This is not complex. It was presented as being complex, but it is not truly a complex case. It's voluminous and extensive, but none of these issues are novel. None of these issues taken individually are particularly difficult to make the proper determination. I would state at the outset, we do stand by all the positions maintained in our briefs. In the event that we don't touch on all of those arguments, we stand by those arguments that we don't elaborate on this afternoon. And I would also point out that the burden rests with the appellant to establish entitlement to relief. Sufficiency claims, the court's well aware of the standard. I'll just reiterate them for purposes of the record. It's viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict. The test is not whether another court or jury might have reached a different conclusion. It's whether this jury was rational in its determinations. All evidence, even that improperly admitted, is to be considered under the hypothetically correct jury charge. Circumstantial evidence alone can support a conviction, and evidence of deception, motive and deception are can be considered as circumstance of guilt. And I would point out, as to all of these charges, the jury has spoken. It is not, most respectfully, the role of this most honorable court to reweigh the evidence.
But it is up to this court to decide whether the jury was properly charged on the corroborating witness. And if this court finds as a matter of law that Moscato was an accomplice as a matter of law, then the charge is incorrect to this jury.
I would concede that point, Madam Justice. That is
so why is Moscato not a corroborating witness as a matter of law?
She is not an accomplice because she did not assume the level of duties required to say she has assumed responsibility for. And I didn't mean to be flippant in my brief, but the court will recollect in my brief, I raised the point of our esteemed president. Whether you agree with him or not, he is an elderly individual under the eyes of the laws of Texas. Would you have his maid, the woman who cooks his food, responsible for his killing, his assassination, because she did not move to protect him? And I would point out a couple issues on that thrust. First off, she worked, Celestina Mascaro at some level worked for Monica Melissa Patterson. She was hired through Monica Patterson. Monica Patterson paid part of her salary. Monica Patterson gave her instruction when she was hired on. You tell me everybody who has contact with Mr. Nell. Then on the day of, she orders her out of the house and then comes before the court and says, well, she failed in a duty to, even if you assume there was such a duty, and there wasn't, I'll discuss that more momentarily. Then she says, she ordered her out of the house and then says, well, she failed to fulfill a duty that didn't exist in the first place when it was the appellant herself who ordered her not to satisfy any such obligation. But as far as the duty, I would point
I think that the statute is clear in order to protect the elderly, even someone like our president, whether you believe him or not. But here we had a 96-year-old man who definitely had someone who was taking care of him for pretty much 24 hours a day and providing more than just cooking his meals, was truly providing a health care. And under this statute, isn't that the real reason we have this statute, in order to protect these individuals who can be taken care of, who can be taken advantage of?
Absolutely, Madam Justice. That is the purpose of the law. And if you had a person who had assumed that responsibility, acknowledged it to provide, not just to help, not just to assist. And I would point out that the statute is a few things about that statute. It is and. It is acted so as to cause that he accepted responsibility for protection and food and shelter and medical care. Certainly, if you view that because it should be read as and, certainly the man's living in his own house. How, even if you say he had some level of responsibility, which I don't believe she did, you certainly can't get all of them. And I would point out, counsel in her reply brief says, well, the state's reading the definition of 2204D narrowly. Hicks tells us, Hicks v. State at 241 Southwest 3rd 543 from the Court of Criminal Appeals tells us that definition is to be read narrowly. What happened in Hicks, I'm sure the court's read the case, but just by way of recap, Hicks involved a disabled man, which legally the same situation, who had been badly mauled at a party. And they picked him up and they said, well, what should we do with him? And they decided, nope, we're not going to do anything with him. We're going to carry him to the ditch, leave him for the ditch, call the deputy. He was charged and convicted for failing to protect this man. And the court very clearly said, merely taking possession of a person in that circumstance does not mean that you have accepted responsibility for protection, care, shelter, and so forth. She was merely a housekeeper. You can call it what you want. She was basically a live-in housekeeper at some of, and she wasn't living there all the time, Madam Justice. And I would point out, too, to be an accomplice, you have to have some role in the underlying offense. She had no role. If she was an accomplice, I don't believe that Texas law recognizes such a thing as an unwitting accomplice. If she was an accomplice, it's because she took steps to inject herself into these facts, and she did nothing of the sort. And as the Honorable Justice herein so aptly notes, this man was 96. He was doing jumping jacks in the office of his counsel weeks before his death. He was lucid. He was complaining, why is everybody trying to take over my life? This was not an invalid. This was not a disabled individual. Merely, most respectfully, Madam Justice, in just a very few years, I'm going to meet the definition of an elderly individual in the eyes of the law of Texas. I believe this is to protect the enfeebled, the vulnerable. This man was not vulnerable except physically, and even then, he's not that physically vulnerable. He's still physically active. In fact, well into his 90s, he was running 4 miles a day. And as to the any error, first, to be an accomplice as a matter of law, Madam Justice, members of the court, one must either have been charged with the offense or have had that charge dismissed because of some sort of an exchange. We will dismiss in exchange for your testimony. So certainly, and under any circumstance, I see the Honorable Justice wishes.
No, I just said, but there's also the third prong that they bring up. I'm sure that they're not going to decide that it's one of two. That the law is that the evidence is so uncontroverted or so one-sided that no reasonable juror could conclude that the witness is not an accomplice. And that's what they're relying on. So they're saying that if we just look at the facts in the light more favorable, there's just no way that we can decide that this Ms. Moscato is not an accomplice as a matter of law.
She was hired to assist Mr. Nell. And I would again point out that the person who selected her and brought her into this situation.
So we've gone through that already, Mr. Okay. Devino. So let's move on to the second prong that I discussed with Ms. Voss, which is even if we are to find that the intent to connect, is there sufficient intent to connect even if we find her as an accomplice as a matter of
certainly.
Law?
Certainly. Even if the court determined that she was an accomplice as a matter of law or that it should have been submitted to the jury and the jury should have been determined if it was an accomplice as a matter of fact. Counsel says, well, we only have one person. We have a lot more than that, Madam Justice. We have her lying about when she was there. She told Ranger, I got there at 9 o'clock. And the example I would use, and I don't mean to sound flippant, if my wife asked me, where did you go? And I stopped at Walmart, but also stopped at a former girlfriend's house on my way home. And I tell her I stopped at Walmart. I have lied to my wife, lied by omission. That's what she did. So we have her deception of when she got there. We have We also have her deception about he's having a heart attack. She knew very well that man had been killed. Yet she tells everybody, she told the Nell family, she told her associates, she told the board, it was a heart attack. We have her physically at the house earlier by cell hawk data, which corroborates what Ms. Goro is telling us. We also have she told us to wait, which is also corroborated by the cell phone data. And we also have testimony that the two argued that morning by telephone. We have those phone records. Ms. Mascoro told us that the two had argued, and that's when Ms.
Well, we need any testimony that doesn't have Mrs. Moscato's.
No, it's what corroborates, Madam Justice, most respectfully. The point is what would corroborate Ms. Mascaro's testimony. Ms. Mascaro says she was there earlier than she claims. That's verified by the cell phone data, which shows that
cell phone. Right.
Which she was, in fact, there. And I would point out, as the Honorable Justice Tirina, the law is very clear, Madam Justice, members of the court. The instruction must be issued if it's warranted. It was not warranted here. The instruction would have been you shall determine as a matter of fact. And counsel, the very attorney who now says it should have been there, conceitedly, she didn't have to make the request, but it's a bit, may create the impression of being a bit disingenuous. Say the court shouldn't have included an instruction, which I never raised with the court. Conceitedly, the law is clear.
Counsel, could you talk a little bit about remuneration?
Yes, Justice Perks, I appreciate the opportunity. And I would point out just an example. If we assume that there is a gang leader who knows that a particular person is an undercover drug agent working to unravel this drug organization. And he has a minion, an underling, kill that drug agent at a gang meeting. The person who actually does the hands-on killing has no knowledge that this person is, in fact, an undercover drug agent. He doesn't know who he's killing. He doesn't care who he's killing. So the undercover drug agent the gang leader goes to trial for capital murder. Murder of a peace officer in the course of his duties, knowing that he was then in the course of his duties. And his argument is, but he could only be convicted of murder. Would we allow a gang leader in those circumstances to escape liability for the crime he committed? Because what we must look at, Mr. Justice Perks, members of the court, is the or both. When Chief relies on Forbes, the or both provision of 701 did not exist at that time. One is criminally responsible for what one does himself, for the actions for another for which she is criminally responsible, or both. And to allow a gang leader under those circumstances to have a known drug agent that he knows is a drug agent killed in the line of duty and escape liability for capital murder merely because he didn't tell his underling the reason behind that killing is an absurd result. I cannot fathom that the legislature meant such an outcome.
Did that answer your question, Mr.
Now, as to Dr. Farley,
okay.
The judge went through a meticulous, as the Honorable Justice Benavides points out. May I take a drink of water, Master Perspective?
Of course you may. Of course, feel free.
Thank you for the courtesy, Madam Justice. As the court so aptly points out, this was not haphazard. This judge went through a meticulous gatekeeping function. I think the court recited 75 pages of outside jury presence record going through line by line. Well, what about this? Did you consider that? What factors did you take into account? And the courts are very clear. The pathologist has two functions to determine mechanically what caused the death and the circumstances thereof. Mechanically, for example, she could determine that someone has died of a crushing of the windpipe by way of a ligature. But until she looks at other information coming from outside, because she also must determine cause, manner of death, circumstance of death, she cannot determine was that accidental, was that deliberate, was that perhaps even a judicial hanging, to be an extreme example. She must rely, because she was not there. 701 tells us that we can rely on reasonably reliable sources, and that's exactly what happened. And I would point out the case of Best, which is concededly unpublished, but the only reason Best is unpublished is not because it's of no merit or no weight. It's because that was a case that went straight to the Court of Criminal Appeals. It's a death penalty case. Mr. Best sits on death row as we stand here today. And in Best, they made a similar claim. The pathologist determined that the victim had been raped forcibly at or near the time of her death. And they said, well, how did you determine that? They challenged the determination because to make that determination, he relied in part on autopsy photos and relied in part on serology results finding some sort of secretion in the woman's body. They said, well, you can't do that. The court said, of course you can. You almost have to.
I think the problem that we're having with Dr. Farley's testimony is that what she relies on is non-medical information in order to arrive at her opinion. She's pushed at the hearing, she says, well, I have the cell tower pings that corroborate the time that the issue was going on. So when she was pushed on every issue as to providing the analytical gap that's necessary to arrive at her medical opinion, that gap was filled by non-medical investigation. And that's the gap that seems to be missing in this case.
Well, I would ask, the philosophical question is, what else would be out there for her to determine what were the circumstances? It's almost by definition, Madam Justice, going to be non-medical information. It's going to be the police officers telling you, well, we found him in a ditch in this position. That's not something she's going to determine medically. And she didn't just look at just multiple sources. She looks at the statements of the, she didn't just look at what the police officers were telling her. She testified in 30 reporters record 30 to 33. I looked at the statements from the witness, from the people who had knowledge. I looked at cell hawk data. She looked at the fact that there was no 911 call immediately made upon the distress of the gentleman. And rule 703.
Well, I know she's trying to put the death of the victim in a content. And so she's trying to provide a timeline. But when she then makes a medical causation opinion, is the issue that we're having as to, yes, does it matter whether you file them in a ditch and which side it is so you can decide whether that caused the death of that individual is very different as to, well, where was the defendant at the time that the death occurred or what time the paramedics got there as to the analytical gap that is necessary. I.e., there's a gap here, and no doctor could tell you of what Mr. Nell passed away from.
Well, let me suggest this, Madam Justice, that Let's assume that there's a death that they cannot determine. They determined medically it was a cessation of the breath, that the breath was cut off while the heart was still pumping. And let's assume later they found a suicide note. What the doctor would, she's got two functions to determine medically what happened and what were the circumstances of that. That suicide note, which is obviously an outside source, not medically related, turns what looks like either natural or homicide or accident into a suicide. And by definition, that has to, much of that can only come from outside sources. The issue is not where it came from or the nature. The issue is, was it reliable? That's what 703 tells us, Madam Justice, is that, I'll recite the rule verbatim, that a expert can rely on information from other sources that is reasonably reliable and used on from in experts in that field. And that's what happened here, Madam Justice. Oh, may I point out, I'm not even going to address the claims of misapplication, double jeopardy claims. Well, that's addressed in our brief. Counsel has not raised any issues about the attempted theft, so I will stand on our briefs as to that point. May I address very briefly the theft, Madam Justice?
Yes, you have 2.5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Justice. On the theft, the jury has spoken. Counsel suggests it's insufficient evidence merely because she, on her claims that, well, they didn't look at this, should have discounted that. The jury has spoken. It is the job of the jury to weigh evidence and consider all evidence. The threshold is there. And I would point out, she claims it was mere guesswork. This was well beyond mere guesswork. They went through line by line. And one of the suggestions from the appellant is, well, How could a new board president suggest that the expenditures for Cody's party weren't authorized? Maybe the former board president would have authorized, maybe he had authorized them. Well, I would suggest this, Madam Justice, member of the court. If there is a government agency, say a school board, that has a new superintendent, he says, well, there is no set of circumstances under this administration or any other where a purchase of gasoline to take a trip to your family, with your family to the beach would have ever been authorized. That's really the thrust of our argument is, well, this particular board president can't speak to the authorizations granted by a prior administrator. I suggest that the jury has discounted that. Those lines of argument were raised in trial. The jury has spoken. And Madam Justice, members of the court, I stand ready for any further questions any member of this panel may have.
In just the last minute you have left, I know that Ms. Voss did not get into it, but her first issue that she was going to speak about before we started questioning her was whether you needed to prove that Anka had first been convicted of capital murder.
No, Madam.
What says he?
Madam Justice, it's the example I provided about the gang leader. The fact that Angel Garza, there's nothing to substantiate in the trial of Monica Patterson that Angel Garza knew why she was telling him to kill that man does not allow her to avoid responsibility. She was killing for murder. She was having the killing done for her own financial gain. The fact that she did not convey that to Angel Garza does not negate. That's an absurd result that I can have somebody killed for money, and as long as that other person doesn't know why I'm doing it, I escape liability for capital murder. That is certainly not what I think the legislature envisioned when it created these statutes. She did it for money, and I would point out they don't even question the sufficiency of the she did it for money element. They're just saying, well, Mario Garza had to have done it for money as well. I would suggest that's almost a line of absurdity, Madam Justice, members of the court. I stand ready for any further questions any member of this court may have.
Does the court have any questions?
No.
That's all we have.
Thank you, Madam Justice.
I'd like to start by talking about count one and the remuneration issue.
Okay.
So as I had started to say before, there are two ways to get to liability in a criminal case. First is if you are the primary actor that has committed the conduct and the mens rea elements of the crime yourself. The second way is if you are a party to the offense. And Section 7.02 sets out the various ways that you can be a party to the offense. And the state chose 7.02A2, which is the aiding and assisting. And if you actually look at 7.02, it talks in terms of the offense. A person is criminally responsible for an offense committed by another person if he aids, assists, and so on in the commission of the offense. So there are scores of cases dating back to the 60s and even before that from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals that said if you are going to be held liable as a party to an offense, you have to prove that an offense occurred. And that really is the problem. Ms. Patterson has been charged with capital murder. However, there is no proof that Mario Angel Garza committed capital murder. There is no evidence, and it is undisputed, that he was not promised or did not expect any remuneration. The state did not put on any evidence of that. The state says, well, Mrs. Patterson expected to receive the benefit of Mr. Nell's estate upon his death. So that they want to transfer that evidence over to Mario Garza to make her guilty as a party to a crime that he never committed. And that just doesn't work. And the way that
wasn't she, Ms. Patterson, already on the accounts for the gentleman? You have the accounts that are there, that PODs and whatnot, and then you have the obviously what happens after death with a will. Wasn't she already on the accounts and was already taking money from those accounts?
The evidence showed that she was a POD payee,
right,
not that she was a joint owner of the accounts. So I don't.
So there's no evidence she was taking money out of the POD accounts?
No, I don't believe there is.
Okay.
Not on her own. So the way that the state tries to get there is they jump over to the more general section in 7.01, which says a person can be responsible for his own for a crime committed by his own conduct, and this statute talks about conduct by his own conduct, by the conduct of another person for whom he's responsible, or by both. And so the state wants to say, oh, okay, well, this crime was committed by both. It wasn't, because if you apply the standard test for separating out a party from a primary actor, what you do is you isolate their conduct and you look at if only their conduct occurred, would there have been a crime? If only this person's conduct occurred, would there have been a crime? And clearly, you don't have that here. If, as the state alleged, Mario's conduct occurred, yeah, that would be a crime. It wouldn't be capital murder. But it could be murder. But you put Monica Melissa Patterson's conduct, there's no crime. She cannot be a primary actor. There was no conduct on her part that constituted an element of the offense. She's just kind of floating out here with this alleged mens rea without it being attached to any conduct by her. There is no crime that's committed by both. It's only party liability. It only can go under 7.02. I'd like to submit an additional brief on a case from the Court of Criminal Appeals that I think has some really unfortunate language, but I think it's dicta, and I don't think that the continuing viability is clear anymore, and it's the Johnson case, if the court will indulge me.
Any objections from the court? You will be. You can, and if the state wants to reply, it may do so.
Thank you, Madam Justice.
You may.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much. This case is under submission, and this court is in recess until further.